All right, good evening. Glad you are with us. We have a lot to cover tonight, and we are moving guests around very quickly because we are supposed to have on tonight the former Attorney General of Brazil. Thank you, Liz. I have a gal that works with us that's just amazing. You probably guys have never heard her name, have you? Liz is all I'm going to tell you for her own security purposes. But we have a lot of people that work with us that whose names you never hear about. Liz is one of them, and she helps secure some of the best guests I have. And this one tonight, the former Attorney General of Brazil. She's also an elected official. They are in an emergency cabinet meeting, I'm told. We've had to bump her and move her around, but we're going to make way for her regardless of what time we have to get her on. So she is in an emergency cabinet meeting in Brazil now. She'll be joining us later. We'll also be joined later by a brand new guest we've never had with us. Rebecca Walzer will be with us to talk about the economy, to talk about this trillions of dollars in money and derivatives and things that, you know, really go over the head of a lot of us that aren't in that field. But she's going to break it down for us in very layman terms. We're also going to be joined tonight by John Giddock. John Giddock, I believe I interviewed John maybe 15 years ago. And I asked someone to help me track him down, and we did. He's written on many, many things. Let me bring up for you real quick just some of the names of his book. He's written on Beslan. You guys all remember what happened in Beslan. If you don't, this is where we had a bunch of Islamists take captive a bunch of children, over 300 people, and kill those over 300, which included many, many, many children. But he's written many books on that. I'm going to find it here in a minute. In fact, I'll just go ahead and introduce him, and he can tell us the names of those books. John, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, sir.
John, what are the name of those three books? I know you'd emailed those to me. What are the names of those?
The first one that I did is Terror at Beslan, a Russian tragedy with lessons for America's schools. The second one is When Terror Returns, the history and future of terrorist mass hostage sieges. And the third one is called Shooter Down, the dramatic untold story of the police response to the Virginia Tech massacre.
All right, let's touch on all those. I finally got them up in front of me. Thank you for that, John. Appreciate it. By the way, do you have a website you want people to visit, John?
Yeah, we have an organization that's a nonprofit. It's a human traffic victim rescue outfit. And that website is
www.searchlightrescue.org.
Searchlightrescuework.org.
Searchlightrescue.org.
Correct.
Okay, I'm going there myself. All right, excellent. All right, so John, tell us about your background, because again, I want to talk to you about Beslan and some of these other things, but tell us about your background, please.
Well, strangely enough, I was a lawyer by trade and ended up working with a new nonprofit terrorism training and consulting outfit that was created by some career Green Berets, FBI supervisory special agents, some other people from the government. And I ended up working with them as a result of a lot of time that I had spent in Russia going back to the waning years of the Soviet Union. I had a lot of contacts there, including contacts with their military. So when the Beslan school siege happened, our board director sent me there knowing that I would have people I knew who would have been part of the rescue team, and ended up doing three trips there over 6 months. And what started out as just a report for the U.S. government turned into the Beslan book. And over time, I ended up doing a master's degree in Russian studies, in large part over there, a PhD in Middle East studies at King's College in London. And the work in counterterrorism just kind of grew for all of us from there.
Wow. Let's talk about Beslan. Remind our audience what that's all about, because, again, John, I apologize. I think I may have interviewed you something like 12 or 15 years ago, because at one time you and a few others were warning about what they would refer to as the perfect day, which was carrying out a Beslan type event, taking hostage American children in many schools across the U.S. in one day. tell our audience about Beslan and why that is a potential threat with our soft target of schools, which, you know, I know you've been saying it longer than I have, but man, when I started interviewing some of you guys about this years ago, I was just appalled at what has happened with the lack of security at our schools.
Yeah, certainly in the face of now hundreds and hundreds of schools having been the targets of mass shooting attacks, security for our schools in order to prevent that, and really the ability of our own, I'll just generally call them security services, to respond to it has not improved commensurate to the threat and hasn't improved commensurate to the reality. The perfect day that you're alluding to, and wow, you have a fantastic memory that you would recall us talking about that so long ago, really was an Al-Qaeda dream plan, if you would, where not only would there be a long series of strategic level attacks on vulnerable targets in the U.S. simultaneously, but it was really an incentivization of everyone, particularly every Muslim, anyone who they felt that they could influence, anyone who was radicalized, to think up their own individual attack and just launch them all on one day in the United States. And even down to an average everyday working person, they were trying to inspire to think up something, even if it was just walking next door and attacking a neighbor. But the reality that we always have to confront, and you know this as well as I, that famed speaker, writer, trainer, Colonel Dave Grossman has always said that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And schools have been one of the most prolific terror targets, certainly in the modern era of terrorism that began in 1968. You just look at what's happened in Afghanistan, Muslim on Muslim, since the U.S. withdrawal in August of 2021, among the many targets, many, many groups of people who have been assaulted and decimated, schools have ranked high in that list just in the past year and a half. And they had been prime terror targets going up to Beslan. And ultimately what you saw in Beslan was the Chechen terrorists, certainly as they were considered in Russia, recognizing the fact that a lot of terror attack methodologies get them some news media attention, but it isn't the sustained, prolonged, in-depth news media attention that they crave and that they really need to send their message. And ultimately, they came to recognize the fact that you take a large group of innocent people hostage and you hold them for days, and you have the continued attention of the news media and the public. But if you hold a large group of students hostage, you hold an entire nation hostage. Mm. You take 1,200 students and you hold them for days in horrible conditions. You kill a number of people, and every single person in that country is scope locked on that television for days, truly terrified of the end result that they fear is sure to come. And that's exactly what the terrorists managed to accomplish with the Beslan school siege, which took place from September 1 to 3 in 2004.
And it ended up over 300 dead. And of that, how many were children?
The majority were children. And over half were children.
And I guess the weather was really hot when that happened at that time, right?
Over the course of those days, about out of the 1,217 hostages, about 900 were held in the gym. Others were held in groups in other places throughout the school. The gym itself, the temperatures with the large windows and the sun beating down on it and all those bodies, temperature inside climbed to well over 100 degrees. There was no air. It was stifling hot. People were made to relieve themselves where they sat on the gym floor.
And I don't mean to be graphic, but the kids got so thirsty, they would urinate in their shirt or coat and then drink it. That's how thirsty they were.
Absolutely. And the parents were making them drink the urine just to try to keep them, quite frankly, alive in the midst of horrible conditions.
And the room was wired with explosives, correct?
The entire school was wired with explosives. The gym itself was wired with explosives. They had three explosives tied into each of the basketball nets. The gym was exactly the size of a basketball court, with just a few inches from the out of bounds line to the wall. And in addition to the explosives tied into the net, they had another explosive hanging from the bottom of the backboard, really just held with duct tape. And the adult hostages in there were concerned about, with the heat and humidity, that the bomb might fall. And the terrorist response when they raised that concern was, we don't care. We came here to die, and you're going to die with us. They had other large explosives on the floor spread across the gym, and a series of 15 of them hanging over the top of the big windows on the two sides of the gym.
Let's show real quick the cover of your book. Folks can get this at Amazon.com. Terror at Beslan, John Gidduck, a Russian tragedy with lessons for America's schools. This happened September 2004. I would have interviewed you sometime around 2007, 2008, somewhere in there, I believe. Now, I don't know if it was you. I'm just going back in my memory bank here. But someone said what they would do is wait for the media to arrive, and then if they could get a administrator, and of course, times have changed since we talked or whoever said this, so it would have been true at the time possibly, but certainly not now. But if they could get an administrator, a principal who was wearing a suit and tie, they would love to take that individual up on the roof, let the media see him, make sure they all have their cameras trained on him, and then shoot him in the head, slit his throat, and push him off. And just do that to go ahead and start inciting what was to come. And that media could be used to go ahead and set the stage of terror. Because again, this is terrorism. But by doing that, they're setting the stage for Americans to say, oh my, these guys mean business. Look what they've just did. I don't know if that was you that told me that scenario, but someone did when I was interviewing them about this.
Yeah, it wasn't something I said, but I understand what was being explained. The thing we have to keep in mind, though, is going back to the numerous plane hijacking terror attacks that we saw in the 1960s and then into the 1970s, response capabilities and response tactics of military units, as well as law enforcement SWAT teams, have continued to evolve and improve. As they evolve and improve, the terrorists study it, and then they change their tactics in response to it. That seeing someone like a principal taken to the top of a school and executed is less likely to happen now than it was in years past, largely because a lot of these teams now, they develop quickly an emergency response assault plan. And once they've arrived and once they're in place, if they start seeing that sort of execution, they're more likely to attack, to launch the rescue operation. And the terrorists don't want that. They want the time for that in-depth, prolonged news media exposure. And they will continue that up until the point where they feel as though they've accomplished whatever their goals are for being there. And if there has not been a negotiated resolution, the government has not negotiated an appeasement resolution for the terrorists, they will then drive the assault on their own timetable. And at that point, they will just begin the mass execution of hostages, so, leaving the arrayed rescue forces no choice but to move in then.
So if such a scenario like this happens, what is the probability that they negotiate and let the kids go? Are they going to say, well, we want these people that are in your federal prisons, you know, let go, these Islamists let go, some of them get let go, they let some kids go? Or what is the probability they let some of them go, but at the end of the day, they want to die in jihad, they know they're going to go down, so they want to die in jihad and secure their spot in, you know, Nirvana or wherever, and their 72 perpetual virgins?
Right. And this gets us to the difference between a martyrdom attack and a fedayeen attack. Martyrdom attacks are pure suicide attacks. That's a suicide bomber. He's not going to walk out of there. Fedayeen attacks are perceived by us, for instance, as suicidal, but they are not necessarily suicide attacks. And when these guys who have been well-trained, they go into these mass hostage sieges, they have an exodus plan. They have something that if the government appeases them, they can get out of there. Russia had two major mass hostage sieges at hospitals before Beslan even. And each time the Russian government gave them the appeasement, negotiated their withdrawal, and they were able to withdraw back to Chechnya. The problem for a government in a mass hostage siege, especially with children, is it is stuck right there in front of the world press with this decision. You either attack and a lot of children are going to die, in which case you're going to have a lot to answer for and it's going to be wildly unpopular, or you appease the terrorists, in which case you guarantee you're going to get more mass hostage sieges, most likely of schools. And that is really the brilliance of the mass hostage siege for these terrorists.
I don't know, again, I don't know if it was you. There was another gentleman I was interviewing that had come out of the Department of Homeland Security, was writing books, talking about this. I think he has since passed away, you know, at a rather young age. And I'd have to go back in my files. He or one of you guys, and again, I can't remember. We're talking about 2007, 2008. And I'd interviewed a few guys on this topic after Beslan in 2004, and that was Islamic groups here in America that have been caught shooting up school buses in practice, having school buses in a field and shooting up those school buses in practice. I have heard of cases from guys that I trust that somewhere, I want to say it was in Texas, some Islamic-looking guys, Middle Eastern-looking guys, boarding a school bus when it stopped at a pickup, wearing a trench coat, gets on the school bus, walks to the back of the school bus, and turns around and walks right back to the front and walks off.
The first instance of that we actually saw in Florida.
Okay.
Two men who had just arrived from Saudi Arabia the night before got on a school bus the next morning. Police were called. They were taken into custody. I'm not going to go into what happened with them after that, but their excuse was they didn't really speak the language. They thought they were getting on a public school bus, but ultimately information was developed to indicate that, to establish that was absolutely false. They knew exactly what they were doing. But we have seen this sort of thing happening with schools, with school buses, hardcore intelligence being gathered on schools, even these groups, these Islamist groups, using excuses to get into schools, to even lease out, for instance, school gyms under the auspices of being part of a Boy Scout troop, just to get into a school and having the run of it for a weekend, sometimes saying they're going to have a basketball tournament, all manner of different subterfuges that they're using. And this has been going on for quite a period of time.
Wow. Let's talk about if you were to have an event like this. If you were to have an event where they hit multiple schools in one day, and God forbid, a bunch of children and staff get killed, the economic consequences, because now you're talking about the need to hire real security, not that we are undermining our school resource officers, but most of us know that a lot of the school resource officers, from what I've seen over the years, are not highly trained in this kind of, you know, like you would have in Israel, or special forces guys or retired special forces guys, unless the school resource officer is a former military special forces guy, which I do think we ought to be hiring a lot more retired military and special forces guys to become security for our schools. Barring that, you have a guy that's maybe not in the best physical condition, one guy for a huge school, far more than he could handle by himself. He's easily removed. So you have a tragedy like this, and everyone says, I'm sorry, but the nice, you know, police officer isn't going to cut it anymore. We need highly skilled, highly trained, 2 to 3 man teams. And now we've got to secure this building, this school, 24 hours a day. So we've got three shifts, 8 hours, 3 times 8 is 24, right? So we've got three shifts we've got to fill with guys, assuming they're taking 8 hour shifts. So we've got three guys to maintain the security of this school. And we've got to do this 3 times 3 is 9. And now we got to multiply that by however many schools we're talking across the country. Even if you did
about 124,000.
Okay. And even if you did two man teams on 8 hour shifts, you're talking, I guess you could go to 12 hour shifts and cut it down. But still, the idea is the math starts piling up real fast for trained people that can secure the building 24/7, because if it's not secured 24/7, that's when people can go in there and plant stuff and do things that you don't want to. You've got to secure the facility 24/7. So now you have the need to find the people that can do that. Now you have the cost. And that's if you're even going to have people say, yeah, I think I'm going to send my kid to the local government school today after having watched, God forbid, thousands of kids across America held hostages in various schools and killed. They're going to say, we're done. They're going to check out. We're done. Now you've got the issue of who's going to leave work in a dual income family today? Who's going to leave work and stay home with the kids and homeschool them, right? So you start to see a serious snowballing in an economic scenario just with what this will do to the nation. True or false?
Well, sir, I feel like I'm in the presence of real genius because I go through exactly that calculation that you just did in my Beslan book, which incidentally, I don't even know if it's available on Amazon anymore. I know people can get it through Dave Grossman's websites, Killology.com and Grossman on Truth.com.
And I have not read your book. I want to read your book. I was planning on ordering your book. But again, you may have said this to me in our interview back in 2007, 2008. That may be where I'm remembering this.
I don't know that I did. I think that it just may be the reality that when anybody really starts looking at this seriously, looking at the long-term consequences, they're going to come up with the same recognitions. And what you just went through, I did, in fact, write about in detail. And part of that is that you attack even two schools with mass hostage sieges in America simultaneously, or even one. The truth is, every school in America is going to shut down. We've already been through that once. The country is going to be reeling from that. Pre-COVID, pre-pandemic, where parents had to figure out how to deal with kids at home, it would have been even more devastating because one parent out of almost every family would have had to drop out of the workforce. We know the reality is it most likely would have been the mothers. And at one point I had, years ago, an accurate calculation of how many women that would have represented leaving the workforce in the tens of millions, and what that alone would have done to the tax base going to the government, and the fact that it would have just had a crushing effect on the U.S. economy, would have driven it into recession, and every school would not have been reopened until not only had it been significantly modified for tactical defensive purposes, and that would have cost an inordinate amount of money, much of which the federal government would have had to figure out a way to fund. But you're right, the schools would not have reopened until you had absolutely top-level tactical combat capable security teams, and most of them probably would have come out of the military.
And now you're talking about the time to require, you know, to get those guys in refresher courses, insured applications. I mean, you're talking basically probably shutting the school down for a whole school year.
That was my estimation. Yes, sir.
Let's move and talk about, let me mention this to you. I don't know if you know, do you know who Todd Benzman is?
I do know the name.
Okay.
I know.
Todd is an expert on the border. He's with CIS.org. Mm-hmm. He's written a book, Border Wars. He's got another one coming out.
I've got his book. I haven't started reading it yet.
Okay. He's got a brand new one coming out real soon on Biden's, you know, what he's doing at the border. But Todd is a regular guest here. And Todd is, and John, I want you to be a regular guest again. I mean, we need to be talking to you regularly. I'm going to order your books. I'm going to find them however I have to. And
email me your address and I'll just put them in the mail.
Okay. Thank you, Logan.
I'll make it easy.
Do that for me, please, Logan. I want to get you back multiple times extensively and go through a lot of this with you. But Todd came on our show 2+ weeks ago now and broke the story here, which was very kind of him to do because he didn't even have an article out yet. And most people, you know, they wait till they have an article to promote. And but he was so distressed by what he saw, he was wanting to come on my show and share it before he even had the article written. He does now have the article written at CIS.org. I'm sure he's got it on his website as well, toddbenzman.com. But he has video and he has pictures of a mosque, Islamic mosque, in Tijuana, Mexico. They have a nonprofit there. And they are housing and then helping get over the border Chechen Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had Rudy Giuliani on my show not too long ago, and I mentioned that to him. And I said, sir, what do you think they're doing? He said, sounds like to me they're planning another Boston bombing attack. And so I'll ask you, knowing Beslan, aren't you mentioning, you know, that was Chechen Muslims, was it not?
Absolutely.
So tell me what your thoughts are. Why are these Chechen Muslims coming to America? Why are they being shoved over our border? What is your concern?
Well, this is something, and my recollection is Todd was a career intel guy, or
yes,
certainly started
yes,
his
yes.
career out as an intel guy.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm like I said, I'm a bit familiar with him. I don't profess to know a great deal about him, but I do have his book. What has been seen down there on that border is actually something that is now going on 20 years old, where we have seen how it used to be going back 20 years ago. The average Mexican, Central South American who really just wanted to come to America to work, send money back home, raise his family, they were paying for quite a number of years about $1,500 a person to the coyotes just to be brought across the border. And then you started seeing that number creep up. It ended up at $2,000, now $3,000. And recent information is that they're paying even more. And the reason for that is these cartel members, the coyotes, were being paid so much money by new groups of people who wanted to be brought into the U.S. We started seeing people being brought over the southern border, 1,967-mile border from Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, all manner of countries from the Middle East, the Arabian Peninsula. And they, back then, were paying $60,000 to $75,000. I have a dear friend and colleague who I'll give him a plug here. You might want to talk to Dr. Mike Bailey, who's a retired Customs and Border Protection commander, has his doctorate in Homeland Security. He now created and runs a Homeland Security program for a college in Texas. Mike is one of the most informed people in the country on what really goes on down there on that border. And Mike and I would trade back and forth the intel, the stuff he was seeing with CBP and information I was getting from other sources. And a little bit ahead of the information CBP even had, I was being told that they were paying $100,000. And that later was verified. And my position has always been, you can have whatever perspective you want on the whole question of illegals coming to the country and whether they should be granted asylum or allowed to work. You can have whatever view you want, but I'm willing to bet that someone isn't paying $100,000 for these people to get jobs as farm workers, as migrant fruit pickers, seasonal help in any industry. It's awfully important for someone to get them there. And if you just look at the information, the data that the government is even willing to acknowledge of how many hundreds of people we have now had come across that border who are now considered, the term is special interest aliens. What that means is, in fact, Chechens, others from the Middle East, others from sometimes North African countries, but less so, being brought across this border and paying untold amounts of money. The government even recognizes hundreds of them that it knows about, and the hundreds that it knows have even been on its own terror watch lists. So again, these people are being brought into this country for a reason, and it is not just to earn a living and send money back home.
And then, of course, and by the way, Annie, one of our associate producers, is telling me that all three books are available on Amazon. So all three
really?
Books, yeah, in fact, look.
Shows you how much I know.
Yeah, look right here, folks. Tarot Beslan says, you know, I can order right now. Then we have, and she checked that, When Terror Returns, The History and Future of Terrorist Mass Hostage Sieges. And then Shoot Her Down, The Dramatic Untold Story of the Police Response to the Virginia Tech Massacre. I know it's, I don't want to put you on the spot, but is there any way we could get you to come back on the show Thursday or Friday night?
Possibly. I am getting on. Do you mean as in tomorrow, Thursday?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I am getting on a plane tomorrow morning. So tomorrow evening might be a possibility. Friday evening wouldn't be.
Okay. Otherwise, sometime next week. I think our audience is going to be very much demanding I get you back on and go through some of these other books and other topics as well. There you go. There you
I
are.
could I could do it. I could do it any day next week.
All right, let's just plan on, how about next Monday? Let's plan to have you back next Monday, same time, 7:30 Central.
Sounds good,
I'll put
sir.
you down 7:30. Let me ask you one final question. That'd be Monday, December 12th. Let me ask you one final question, and that is, with all of your research on Russia, what are your thoughts in regards to like nuclear suitcases? I know one former KGB officer, Galutsin, was warning years ago about nuclear suitcases. My friend, the late Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, I don't know if you ever had the chance to know Dr. Pry. We produced his radio show, his TV show, a CIA analyst, Peter Pry. Sadly, he passed away in August. But he actually, if you go to the Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., you'll see a nuclear suitcase that's mocked up in the small print there. It mentions his name because he was the one that did the measurements and the whole detail to say, you know, for Congressman Kurt Weldon and Dan Coats to present in a congressional committee and say, this is about the size that, you know, you could do with a suitcase, and this is the damage it could do. And we're talking massive. What do you think of some of these old things that were said by Galutsin, former KGB officers, warning about small tactical nukes? And then you have the guy that was on the killer, the shoot to kill list during the Iraq War, whose family has now got a contract with Gulf-Tainer. They've got a contract to run some of our ports in Florida and other places, and they're tied right back to the Club K cars. The lids lift up pops 2 to 4 silos, small missiles, and that guy that was whose family is tied to all that, he was on the kill list. He was the head of Saddam Hussein's nuclear program, Dr. Jafar. I believe he was the one that actually came up and developed the nuclear suit or the nuclear beach ball, real small little device. So we're talking about people that have penetrated, you know, behind the wire here in America in some key places. What are your thoughts about things like either you know, Club K car or nuclear suitcases in America?
I really can't speak to the Club K car. The nuclear suitcase is a little bit of a different issue for me, and I am no expert by any means. But one of the reasons why I had contacts in Russia who were going to have been at Beslan as part of the rescue effort. Over the years, I spent a handful of years training with some Russian Spetsnaz, some Russian Special Forces units. I had become friends with the head of the KGB for the St. Petersburg region through my studies over there, who actually was Putin's boss back in those days.
Wow.
And among the Spetsnaz soldiers that I got to know well, a number of whom I've had here to the US to visit, a couple of them had been involved in the nuclear suitcase program. So through them, I did get to learn a bit. And obviously, when you're talking any sort of weapons grade radioactive material, it's always going to be a problem. For the stuff that was built during the Soviet era, one of the advantages to the US was that, like everything the Soviets built, they always had pretty good design but horrible manufacture. So they were made with components that weren't constituted of the pure metal and sometimes pure gold that they needed to be. And so a lot of times that stuff would degrade, which would reduce the effectiveness of their deployment. That doesn't mean, though, that anybody with those nuclear suitcases doesn't still have weapons grade radioactive material. And that's where the threat of far less sophisticated dirty bombs comes in here to the US.
Not to
And
mention,
certainly when,
not to
go
mention
ahead, I'm
bringing
sorry.
in, not to mention bringing in maybe new technology though,
Absolutely.
new
And
suitcases, not relying on the old ones that have maybe timed out in some ways.
well, or just trying to fix the components, replace the components that would have degraded. And certainly there's been information that that's something Osama bin Laden was looking at doing, and he had hired some former top level Soviet nuclear scientists for that very purpose. But we also have to recognize the fact that we are the number one repository, destination location for illicit drugs throughout the world. The United States is. And if those drugs are coming in those huge quantities, which they are, anything like that, and certainly a literal suitcase, a bag that you're going to carry around that was, I'm trying to remember, 22 kilograms, if I'm remembering correctly what I was told, which was a good bit smaller and lighter than the man-pack nukes that our own special forces would carry back in those days, back in the days of the Cold War, or at least be prepared to carry. Yeah, certainly they can get in just as easily. For having millions of people walk across the border down south, we know they're all bringing something.
Absolutely, they're bringing something. John Giddock, I hope you guys will check out his book. Look at him real quick on the screen here. Terror at Beslan, it's available on Amazon. When Terror Returns, available on Amazon. And Shooter Down, we're going to have him on next Monday night, 7:30 Central. Write it down. He also has an organization he works with, and that's it right there. Searchlightrescue.org, searchlightrescue.org. John, great to be reacquainted with you. I look forward to having you on regularly, and I look forward to having you on Monday night at 7:30 Central.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate you having me. It's noble work you're doing on your network.
Well, you're very kind. We look forward to having you a part of it regularly. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Check out his website, folks. Check out his books. I'm going to get all three of them. I can't wait to read them.